Do we think that there still needs to be an RJ coordinator role position at a school site, or if the implementation team, if a group of other people could also carry that work? What You Know About RJ, Restorative Justice, Sharing Stories and Skills, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. I'm your host, Gopher Salazar. And as you know, we've been highlighting the different stories of folks that have been on the RJ in Schools team presently and also past. And so I'm super, super excited today on this recording day of Friday to have in front of me a very, very special guest, Mr. Joseph Luciani. How are you, Joseph?
Great. It's great to be with you, Gilbert.
I'm happy that to have this conversation with you. I want folks to know that when I first started here at RJ in Schools with CCJ, Joseph was already on the team, even before there was a team. And so Joseph was really a part of my initial training and work here doing in RJ in Schools. So I'm super excited to have you. What we've been doing is we've been asking everybody kind of the same questions at the beginning. And the first question is, like we do in Circle, what's your name? And if you could share something about your name.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Joseph. Last name Luciani Cervantes. And my name, you know, it's funny you asked that question because I really start thinking about my name because of those, you know, restorative practices. I've never really thought about, you know, the meaning of my name and everything. Mm-hmm. And so... basically, my name, it comes from the Hebrew, from the Bible, from Joseph, and it means God will increase. And yeah, you know, it makes sense to me. And my last name comes from the Latin, and it actually means light. So if you put it together, you know, it's kind of cool, a cool meaning. Mm-hmm. So... That's what I can say about the meaning of it. In terms of the story, you know, growing up, I didn't really like my name. People would make fun of me. I mean, I'm talking about like when I was really little, like, a child.
Uh-huh.
People would, you know, make fun of me and be like, hey, Joseph, hey, where is Mary? Where is Jesus? You know? And at the time, it really bothered me to the point where I wanted to change my name. But I never did, and so I'm glad I'm still Joseph today, you know.
I don't think I knew the full, I don't know if I knew the full story. Maybe it had been so long since I heard that
probably.
Question from you or that
yeah.
response.
Yeah, it's possible.
And the Cervantes? What about that one?
Well, that's my wife's name. Uh-huh. And we both we put our name together. I phonated it. So, my name and her name, and now it's our name. Mm-hmm. And then our daughter is the same. She has both. Luciani Cervantes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got a lot of comments about that actually, and for me it was more a natural thing to put our name together. So,
mm. Well, I want to say right now that I had the blessing to be invited to Joseph and Anna's wedding ceremony and the Nisala's baptism. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me having you across the table in this conversation also just kind of highlighting the relationships in the community that exists in this work. And so I just wanted to name that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think connects to the next question that I've been asking everybody on the team is, in this work, what has brought you joy doing RJ?
I mean, a lot of things, really. I mean, you just mentioned the relationship. It definitely, you know, before I started this work, it's not something I had envisioned. You know, all the relationship I've been creating, doing this work, and it goes way beyond the work. It goes, you know, to friendship, to long lasting relationship, and so that definitely brought me a lot of joy, and it still brings me a lot of joy. Another thing that brings me a lot of joy is to see the transformation and the power of this work. So as you know, I've been working, I worked for 5 years as a restorative justice coordinator in a high school, Hawkins High School, in South Los Angeles, and seeing the transformation that happened during those 5 years, with students, with teachers, with staff, with myself, that definitely brought me a lot of joy. And then just, I mean, you know, I think for RGA practitioners that are in circle a lot, there's just countless of circles that bring you joy in the moment, you know?
So you mentioned you work with RGA in schools, and I wanted to ask her for you to talk about the, not just what anything else you want to share about your work as an RGA coordinator, but also when you transitioned into the other department here that we have CCJ called RPIC, mm-hmm. and what your work has been there. And maybe if you could think of, like, talk about what have been any of the similarities or differences, or how that work just impacted you.
Yeah. Yeah, my work at the high school, I think I was very, I got very lucky to be in that space with people that kind of really bought in this process and were really open to implement restorative justice. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, it wasn't a struggle to really convince people that there was some real power and value of implementing restorative justice practices in schools, which I know in other schools is not the case, right? You have to do a lot more work of like trying to just have people listen to you, right? Or like even, you know, consider doing restorative justice. And there, you know, I was very lucky to have admin and teachers really supportive. It doesn't mean that the work was easy, but, you know, at least the implementation of it, people were open. And so, I spent 5 years there really implementing the practices. We were implementing community building practices just to build community and relationship between students and their teachers, between students and themselves, I mean, and their peers, with staff and so forth. We had a system where we would do, all the teachers were trained in doing those community building circles, and we're doing it once a week. So every week of the year, once a week, they would do a community building circle. So that definitely built the community and also built the skills of students, you know, being able to listen to each other, to share, you know, to build community and so forth. And then the other piece was really responding to harm using restorative practices. And so, and that, you know, that's where I really, I guess that's where most of my time was spent on. It was, you know, with the help of the administration, of the counselors and so forth, really trying to respond to harm in a restorative way. Mm-hmm. And so we would have circle after, you know, any, like a fight or bullying or whatever happened in the school, those kind of incidents, we would try to resolve it in a restorative way. And so, and that's a good segue into my current position as a case manager now at the restorative practices in communities, where we work with youth that have been cited and charged, and we have a diversion program. And so it's a restorative program, so we go through, you know, it's also a circle, it's also meeting, you know, with the families, meeting with the person harmed, but it's not in a school context, it's more in a law enforcement context. And it's also, I mean, it's powerful work as well. It's just, it's a different context, there's different consequences, right? Because in schools, we wouldn't go, like, we would get those incidents before mm-hmm. they would get escalated to a citation or, you know, to law enforcement involvement. Here, we get a referral from the law enforcement agencies, like, directly. So it has different consequences for the youth involved. Now, the type of incident, actually, sometimes they're very similar, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're actually much less serious coming from the law enforcement. And so that's what was kind of, you know, a little frustrating, because a lot of those incidents could have been dealt way before mm-hmm. it gets to the citation point, right? Mm-hmm. So in a lot of our cases, it's like, why do we even get this case? It shouldn't even be here, right? Something like a loitering or a curfew violation, or sometimes we get referred from schools as well. But so those schools, instead of responding in a restorative way, like we would do at Hawkins, mm-hmm. those schools would send it to the police and let the police deal with it. And the way the police deal with it, it's by citing people, mm-hmm. right? They don't, I mean, that's their tool, right? Like, our tool is to do restorative circles or other restorative practices. The police tool is to cite people, right? So, but those have very different consequences. So we would also get those cases from school, like a fight or whatever, would get cited to us, would get referred to us for a battery citation or whatever, or even assault. At Hawkins, it would have been dealt very different, mm-hmm. right? It would have not gone through law enforcement involvement. Instead, I mean, for a very serious case, you know, sometimes just by district policies, we have to, you know, I mean, the administration have to contact the police and so forth. But all kinds of, you know, fights and other, you know, argument or whatever, those were like directly dealt with restorative practices.
I remember your school was much different from my school when I was a coordinator. And I think one of the first things that really surprised me was I remember when I first met the principals and the APs, they were in circle, in like they're like in your classroom, like in your room, which was, it took months for that mm-hmm. to happen in my school site. When I moved from being an RJ coordinator to then being officially with CCEJ, Belly, our director, had trained me. She was our coach. This is when I was with another organization, and moved into this position of coach or strategist, which is not being a coordinator at like one specific site, but working with multiple school sites and implementation. I know that we've always had this conversation internally, you and I in the department, around an RJ coordinator versus this implementation team model. So I wanted to bring the conversation to that of, do we think that there still needs to be an RJ coordinator role position at a school site, or if the implementation team, if a group of other people could also carry that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I don't have a definite answer.
Mm-hmm.
My experience, I think it was very important to have that coordinator on campus, you know, kind of full-time, at least in the beginning. And the reason is because, it's just a lot of work, especially in the beginning. You know, even when you have people that are already buying into the process, it's just a lot of work implementing it. And so I don't see how, like, it's technically possible for, you know, teacher or administrator or counselor or other staff that already have their full-time job, right, to then put that on their plate. And so in my experience, what ends up happening when people, you know, do that is that then the RJP is kind of, you know, fall back because they don't really have the time to really do it, you know, or they do it kind of, you know, half,
not to the fullest, not, like impact or
exactly. So, but I mean, that's my experience. I haven't experienced the implementation, you know, kind of team, as you do. And I mean, it seems like you have great result as well, doing that, you know, model. So, and like I said, I don't have a definite answer about like what was the best approach. I think what's important is to really, like, I'm thinking for people that are thinking about like how to implement that in my school, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has to make sense to them. And also, money shouldn't be the deciding factor.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the money is the deciding factor, then you're not going to do a good job about it. Because you can always find cheap ways to say that, you know, you're implementing it, but it has to be a real commitment. And that's what I really appreciated about my principals. We have three principals because there's three small schools at Hawkins, right? And it was a very collaborative team. And we had a lot of visits from schools that would come to Hawkins to see how it was implemented, you know, what was working, what was not. And they were coming because they wanted to eventually, you know, implement restorative practices. And one of my principal, Mr. Terry, was always saying, it was always very real, you know, he kept it real with people, saying that the investment is, he was always saying the first year, the investment is like $100,000. And that, I mean, that's a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And so people were like, oh, wow, like, well, we don't have that kind of money. Well, what else can we do? But and the reason why he was saying $100,000 because that's the grant that we had for the first year that was funding our restorative justice implementation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the grant they got from California Endowment. And with that grant, we were able to, you know, train teachers, you know, do coaching, and then hire a RJ coordinator
mm-hmm.
position. And they realized, you know, the principals and other staff realized that without that kind of money to do all those things, the implementation of Hawkins wouldn't have been the same. And we wouldn't have been at the level where we were at.
Mm-hmm.
So they recognized that. But for some people, I don't know if they're ready for it. I don't know if they're ready to hear that, and I don't know if they're ready to really put the money where they say their heart is or their mouth. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a challenge, because I'm sure, and I'm not saying, I mean, obviously not everybody has $100,000 to put in to implement RJ, mm-hmm. even if you're really motivated about it or whatever. But resources are needed, especially in the beginning, mm-hmm. to implement it. Now, you know, I spent 5 years at Hawkins. I really think maybe the 2-3 first years, I really feel like, you know, my role was really important for the implementation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe after 3 years, if you know, the school is kind of running with it and it's really, you know, it's well implemented, maybe like a full-time coordinator is not, you know, maybe you could do without a coordinator mm-hmm. at that point. But even that, I'm not sure. I mean, I was still useful, you know, after that. But maybe if you build capacity, you know, in your staff and some other people can take that on, maybe it could work, I think.
I feel like there's still a lot of similarities between the coordinator role and then this role, the coach or strategist. This coming school year, for some of my school sites, it's going to be their fourth or fifth year with us and with me in this role. And in year one, year two, there was way more coaching hours that the contracts would have. There was more trainings.
Mm-hmm.
And coming up this year, I think with two schools particularly, I feel like this year coming up could very well be the last year in terms of support from me, because I feel like they're already very sustainable. There's already systems in place. You know, some schools don't have advisory. And when we come in and I talk about circles, the first question is like, well, this is great, but when are we supposed to do this?
Right.
And so some schools have already put in the time for circles, the time to train people, the time to give people support, the time to plan for circles. And so I'm thinking about kind of the similarities, because in this year coming up, there's with two schools, it's maybe like 20-25 hours of support, where the last few years it's been like 30 or more.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, for sure. And I'm wondering, in your schools, the schools that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
are those schools also doing harm circles and repairing harm?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. No. And they're mm-hmm. the folks in... So in one of two of these schools, the dean of culture has been trained in harm circles and has been doing mostly restorative dialogue for interventions. Uh-huh. This year, there hasn't seemed to be a huge need for interventions. But this year and the year before, there's been way more practice in circle, and there's been more practice of these grade level circles. So doing the circle structure within the whole grade level to talk about, to go into community building, to go into games, but then to get into specific topics like bullying or harassment or sexual harassment.
Right.
This other school site, they've been really focusing on training folks in restorative dialogue, and they're trying to do a reset to do more of a regular circle practice next year. And the admin hasn't been training harm and conflict, but I did train them motivational interviewing, and they're also implementing that into their into their work next year. So to answer your question, they're not fully doing the Harmony Conflict work, but there's also the response that they've been doing way more work around the prevention sort of dialogue and circles. And so the thing that we always say is that the more that relationships are built, the less of a need there could be for intervention sort of on the daily basis.
Right.
And so I've been seeing that with them, but not fully there. We're trying to move into harm and conflict training with the second school site where the admin hasn't been trained yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I think, you know, I definitely believe in the importance of community building, because like you said, I think the assumption, I think it's the right assumption that when you build community, when you build, you know, healthy relationships between students and students and their staff and their teachers, you would definitely see less of a need for intervention, right? Because when people are in a healthy relationship with each other, they're less likely to harm each other, right? I think that's fair to assume. But I think maybe that's the difference. When you have a coordinator on campus, I think there's more capacity to do those harm and conflict circle. Because at Hawkins, we were able to do that the first year. So we were rolling both community building and harm and conflict at the same time. And I think when you don't have a coordinator, that's harder to do, because for two reasons. I think the harm and conflict first require, you know, I think it requires a little higher level of skills to conduct those. Because it's just more, you know, it's more emotions to deal with. There's more, you know, feelings. It's just, those circles are a little more intense, you know, because you're talking about a harm, right? And so I think that's one thing. And then the other thing is that I think it's very time consuming to do harm and conflict circle, because you have to prep with both parties or more than both parties, like however many parties are involved. You got to prep individually with those people, right? To like kind of just understand what's going on, what happened, you know, the rhetoric questions, right? And what are the needs? And so you got to do that prep. You got to, you know, see where the admin are at, you know, what's their plan. And so there's a lot of logistics going into that before even going to the circle. And then you have the circle that, you know, can take an hour or 2 hours or whatever. And then you have the follow-up of like following up about the agreement and stuff like that. So it's just a lot of work. It's very time consuming. I think the community building piece, teachers can definitely take that on much more easier. You know what I mean? Because they can put that in their class time, even though there's, like you mentioned earlier, like you have to figure out if there's an advisory, like when are we doing circle? But when you carve that time out, I mean, that time in to do circle, and it becomes a routine, I think that's, you know, a little easier. But for harm and conflict, well, first of all, there's no set time for that, right? You got to respond to whatever the conflict is or the harm is. So you cannot say like, oh, well, Friday I'm going to do harm circle. You know, it doesn't work that way. You got to respond whenever the situation is happening. And teacher cannot respond to a conflict that they're themselves involved in, right? Because a third party facilitator, you know, and then you need other people that have been impacted. So I think if school want to move to that, they need someone that will have the time. And that's what I was telling earlier, like that teachers or staff or counselors, you know, don't have, like they already have a full-time job. So how are they going to then, it's basically another full-time job, at least in my experience, that's what it was, at least the three first years. It was definitely a full-time job to do all that prep, all that, you know, logistics and responding to harm. Now, it also depends, like you said, some of your school don't really have a need for a lot of intervention, and that's, you know, that's the case, that's great. In my school, there's definitely a high need for intervention. And I guess it depends also like the kind of, you know, environment you're in, right? My school, you know, was in South Los Angeles. There was a lot of need for pretty much, I mean, for intervention, but for, you know, there was just, you know, a lot going on. And so students were dealing with a lot of things, you know, at home or in the community, in the neighborhood. And, you know, obviously they bring that to school. And so how do you create a safe space at school that's different than what they encounter outside of school? and then also respond to things when it happens, when they bring that stuff in school. So there was definitely a high need for community building,
mm-hmm.
for, you know, trust building, for all of that, and then for repairing harm
mm-hmm.
when it happens.
And there was a high need. When I was a coordinator, there was a huge need for interventions. And
yeah.
So when I first started, like I'm hearing you say, when I first started, I was doing harm circles. I mean, there was no access to a room to have circle. There was very few access to teachers to do circle, to model circles in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But what there was access to was a ton of students in attendance waiting to speak to intervention counselor or the AP, and a storage room. And so the limited knowledge that the school knew about what RJ was, and the limited courage I had at the time to advocate for the work and also to really fully understand it. So I would be in the storage room with two students talking about the fight that either just happened or was about to happen. And it wasn't until the second semester that I was able to do more circles, so, which was the exact opposite of what correct implementation should be.
Mm-hmm.
But that reminds me also that when we first started, it was really just community building training and harm and conflict training. Those were the only really two that we offered.
Right.
And I remember there was three of us who were sort of, you were, Joseph has always been an OG coordinator, object coordinator, but with CCJ, with the other org that I was first working with, that CCJ had trained us, there was three other RJ coordinators initially with LUSD schools other than you, because you were the first one,
mm-hmm.
to my knowledge. And so my colleague Nayoka, who was at Gompers a few blocks away from us in Watts, when she and I just began doing community building training, we had seen how the affective statements and the restorative questions, which used to be a part of community building training, a lot of teachers were just really stuck on those, around those are skills or the need for those, or they just needed more time to talk about it and to understand it and to really see it as why it should be a restorative practice. So that was when Nayoka and I pulled those two skills and really said, this should be its own separate training. And we need to include, Nayoka had said, you know, we should include active listening and motivational interviewing. So I feel like since then, adding the restorative dialogue training and adding that as part of coaching and encouraging schools to do that, I think that that has been sort of this middle road between community building circles
mm-hmm.
and harm and conflict, because I'm thinking about the second of the two schools that I mentioned. They've gone deep into RD, multiple PD sessions trained actually by teacher leaders, and they actually ended the year, their last school culture PD was RD battle, where the school
mm-hmm.
culture team split the staff into two groups, would give them a scenario, and each group had to step into the middle of the space and give a response, like an affective statement response, and then the school culture leads as judges had to judge based on the
mm-hmm.
documents that we have if that had all of the things required for a full impactful
mm-hmm.
affective statement. And then they did that for RQ, for sorted questions. I think also, and kind of still going back to this whole RJ coordinator or task force model with the support of a culture strategist, I think we've also added different trainings
mm-hmm.
and I think that we've been spending more time on mindset
mm-hmm.
and then I think we did when we first started, and I the mindset was the hardest thing when I was a coordinator to really get through and to get over for adults.
Right.
Because there's been the RD, the trauma sensitivity, the
mm-hmm.
games and
mm-hmm.
team builder. So there's been a lot more in a very specific sequence that we've been doing with teachers. So I think that's been different too. And I think that has been impactful too.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you 100%. But I also think those two are not mutually exclusive. So for example, in my school, you know, you're right. In the first year, it was mostly, you know, community harm and struggle,
mm-hmm.
Harm and conflict. And then we realized that, like you said, it was not enough. It's not enough to just, you know, have those two things. There's different, you know, there's other things that are needed, because not every restorative conversation it's happening in circle, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, most of it is happening on a one-on-one basis, you know, in the hallway, or how do you respond with it, you know, to a kid throwing a pencil or whatever. You're not going to have a circle about that, right?
Yeah.
But that response can be very, very important. Mm-hmm. It can set a tone of like, in what kind of environment you are, right? If the teacher is yelling at you, hey, pick up that, you know, that pencil, whatever, or, you know, go to the counselor, whatever. That sets the tone for a very non-restorative environment, right? Or in the opposite, if you respond in a different ways. And that's why, you know, Hawkins, so the second year, I remember, you know, was talking to the administrators, the principals, and they also recognized the need for affective statement, for restorative dialogue, restorative conversation. And then we also saw the need for games and activities in circle, right? Because even though teachers were having great conversations in community building sometimes, sometimes there was the need of like, hey, let's just have fun this time, you know? Because if every week the conversation you have is deep and like, you know, it gets to that level, sometimes you need fun, right? So, and that's why I was very grateful for your expertise in that, you know, the master of games, to bring that training. And I know you came to Hawkins to those training in different PDs. Okay. Yeah. And so, and same thing for the affective statements, you know, Belia was there. And so I think we brought that as well. And I think, I mean, we're lucky because we have different people, right, at CCEJ that can do that. So, it doesn't have to be like the coordinator doing all of that. Because and frankly, like, you know, my skills at, you know, doing those PDs, they were just like other people were better at getting that point across, or, you know, or teaching those games and activities and affective statements and all that. So so I think it's great when you have a team or you have different skill set that can and bring that. So we try to do that at Hawkins, to bring those skills that were needed, that are beyond just community building or harm and conflict circle. And also because, and I think Belia always say that, you know, you can have a teacher trained in restorative circles and doing restorative circle. But if, like you said, the mindset, right? Like if that person is still non-restorative doing a restorative process, it doesn't necessarily make it restorative, or it doesn't make it necessarily positive, right? Like you can be very non-restorative facilitating a circle, right? Like the process itself is not enough. Or like if you know you have a teacher that that's very punitive on a daily basis in his classroom for, you know, responding to behavior and everything, and then that same teacher does it like on Friday or whatever, we had circle on Friday, we said, hey, it's time for circle. Like how are students gonna see that circle? Like they're gonna be like, well, this guy is yelling at us the whole week, and now he want us to share our feelings. Like I don't want to share my feelings with this guy, right? Like, so again, to say that the process itself is not enough. And at least my experience at Hawkins, there was definitely not 100% of teachers with that restorative mindset, right? There's like definitely teachers that even after going through the training and all that, still don't really buy into that, or, you know, don't really believe in the power of that, or still have old school kind of mentality of like, you know, we need to, you know, suspend this kid for that behavior. Or we need to do something about it, or, you know, whatever. Or, you know, RJ and doing a circle is not going to change anything. So why are we doing this, right? So, and I mean, I haven't seen a school yet where like 100% of the staff is like super restorative. Like, mm-hmm. I haven't seen it yet. Maybe maybe with your model, you have more success with that, you know, with teachers, with a bigger percentage of teacher like buying into it. I don't know.
I mean, I really appreciated that you brought up money. Money has not been brought up in any conversation that we've had in this podcast, and that's real. I think the older that I get, I see not just money as a factor in life in general, but also time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember so. Because like you said, when you talk about money, it's trainings, it's substitutes for teachers. If the training is during the day, it's you know, food, it's time, it's supplies, materials, money for the trainers and all of that. And so it's a question of how do we want to invest time in culture and in relationship? Because either way, time and money has to be used. Those are the two resources that we have to use no matter what.
Yeah. Well, and I think sometimes I'm sure you heard this, like, you know, teachers or staff or schools, they like, we don't have time to do this, right? Like, it's too much time. And it's true, right? Especially in the beginning, it takes time because you need to, like, create new structures and time, you know, for practices and conversation and everything. But I think sometimes, to me, it feels like the time question is kind of I don't know if an excuse is the right word, but, like, so that, you know, we just push that away and we don't have to deal with it. Like, it's just like, oh, you know, it takes too much time and I want to try. But it's because I think it's uncomfortable for people to try this new thing, right? Because it's so far away from everything that they've been practicing for so long. We as people, we've been raised a certain way, you know, we've been at school with a certain kind of discipline. And so to do that mental transformation of like, you know, hey, I'm going to try something different, that takes a lot. You know, especially for adults, I think for students, they're more willing to try new things, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're still at an age where they're experiencing things, you know, they're about life and about who they are and all of that. So I think they're more open to try new things. I think for adults that, you know, have been teaching for 30 years, let's say, in a certain way, and then you as a outsider, right? Because I'm not a teacher, I don't have a credential, right? So like, I understand, right? Teachers might be like, well, what do you know about being in the classroom? What do you know about teaching kids, right? You don't know it, right? So why should I listen to you about how I'm going to manage my class, right? So I think it's very hard, and I'm not judging. It's just, you know, I understand why it's hard, because if you've been doing something for that long, a certain way, and then you have that new thing coming in, and it's like, well, I'm not sure if I want to do it, right? Because it would change everything about what I've been doing, right? And so I think that's asking, like, we're asking a lot of teachers, especially, I think, more experienced teachers, to change their mindset, right? Mm-hmm. New teachers, maybe, like, you know, because they're still learning. I mean, everybody's still learning, but you know what I mean? Like, they're still trying to figure out, maybe it's easier to take on that new practice. But I think for people that have been teaching for 30 years or, you know, 20 or whatever, there might be more resistance. And it's normal. Like, again, it's not a judgment or anything. It's just, I think it's just harder, you know?
In a way, there's a little bit less I see of that, of the, how am I supposed to do this? Or what do you have to teach me about managing behaviors? There's a little bit less of that, but what it is now is I'm not supposed to use vocal defiance, or we're not spelling or expelling. What is this, and how does it relate to me being able to teach and just being able to learn? So I recently at a district I had those voices come up and had to just come back to the framing of the work, and now we have these restorative belief statements that it really expressed and created, so those have been really grounding. But so there still is, I think, yes, we are asking a lot of teachers. The work of being a teacher ask a lot of an adult, and schools are still very much institutions are not always the most respectful of people, and so there's a lot of layers to battle or to get through when we come in for the first time and talking about this work or showing the images that we have, or, you know, we're going to play a game, and there's still, in many ways, those very critical questions as there were years ago. Do you think that we solved the question about RJ coordinator implementation team task force?
Well, I think we need more data, you know, more research. I think in terms of data and evaluation, and really see what's working and what's not, and also be ready for maybe, like, you know, not having the answer that we want to hear, right? Like, because we all believe in this work, and we're doing this work because we know that it's working. Mm-hmm. But But at the same time, are we ready to be critical about it? Like, you know, is there things that need to be changed, right? I actually just, I think it was like a few months ago now, there was a study that was the impact of racial justice in some schools. I think it was in Pittsburgh or something, on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because actually they saw that in terms of, so I don't know, you read that. Yeah. And I'm not sure, I don't remember exactly what it was now, but basically there was no like significant difference between schools that had implemented RJ and schools that hadn't, in terms of, I think academic performance, in terms of even, number of suspension. And I mean, I don't remember exactly, but it was very interesting that it wasn't as like, that huge difference, you know, that we want to believe, you know? And so it was just, you know, it's interesting because then it kind of pushes you to like sometimes revise what you think is working and what might not, you know what I mean?
It's also, it's really challenging to measure culture and to measure.
Definitely.
I mean, you could look at absenteeism and attendance and I think also mentioning, you know, we don't claim like academic improvements with this work. And I remember that was one of the main things that the article was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, there was also a question around its implementation and like in the,
right,
what support, what were the trains, what were the support? And so I think even calling something RJ, different organizations train in different ways, or not every organization provides coaching as well. And so I think that there's always those differences too. It's not one common way to do it.
For sure. Uh-huh. Yeah, for sure. And, I agree with you. Just to come back to your point, I think maybe we're not claiming like about the academic improvement, but I think one of the philosophy behind why we are implementing RJ in schools is the belief of that, you know, if there is less suspension, if kids spend more time in class, you know, if they trust their teachers more, if they have better relationship with, you know, with their peers and with their staff, they're going to perform better, right? That's kind of the theory behind it, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what I've heard RJ practitioners say and believe, and I think it's, you know, it's not a bad assumption, is that if we create a better environment for everyone in the school, everyone will perform better,
mm-hmm.
including teachers, including students, including everyone, right? Which makes sense. I mean, if you create a safe environment, people are able to thrive better, right? So I think
it's also not considering or thinking about the various levels of trauma and other resources and supports that kind of even go beyond this work too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, that's where I've always focused on that, is that RJ by itself is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be part of a bigger system of support for what you just said, right? For like the trauma, because like a restorative intervention, a circle or whatever, might, you know, address that one incident, but the one circle is not going to change a behavior or change or heal trauma or, you know, or address that student needs, you know, that student might be homeless, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if that student was involved in whatever, right, and you address that incident and you repaired it, great. But that student at the end of the struggle is still homeless and it still deals with that, right?
Yeah.
Or if a student is in a very dysfunctioning home, right, where there's like domestic abuse or there's violence or whatever, and at school something happened, you repair that, okay, great. But again, that student at the end of the circle is coming back to that environment,
mm-hmm.
right? And where that creates other, and so you it's almost guaranteed that you're going to see that student behaving a certain way because of those trauma and those other factors, yeah, right?
Yeah, so that's where behavior is a response because of all those
traumas. Exactly. Those traumas. Uh-huh. And so that's when you need the mental health, mm-hmm. right? That's where you need the support. Sometimes you need academic support, right? In my school, we had students that come to ninth grade with, you know, fourth grade level reading,
yeah,
or math ability, right? And so same thing, you can repair an incident, but how do you address that, right? So you need academic support. You need, so there's a lot of things that you need to respond to that student need.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very good point. You know, restorative practices by itself is not going to change, resolve everything.
I wanted to begin to close out. What is something, and I've also been asking this for other folks on the team, is what's something that RJ has taught you or impacted you in your life?
I mean, it's a great question.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it brought so much to me personally, right? I think I'll never be the same person. It brought me just the ability to deal with my feelings, to be able to express my feelings, right? To be comfortable with other people's emotions. And that's definitely something that is so important in your personal life or in your professional life, you know, whatever. And so even if I don't do RJ professionally, I might not do that for the rest of my career, but it's something that will always be with me, right? Like it's not just something I do, it's who I am now. You know what I mean? Like it became part of me.
Do you think that you came in already being restorative?
Before learning about it and everything?
Or that you became restorative as a result of doing the work?
I mean, so people always say, like, you know, I have a peaceful energy or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. I've heard that, right? But in terms of, like, really applying and understanding, I think I did learn that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer with that. Like, I think you can be restorative naturally. But there's still skills that can be taught and learned.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I want to say that, yes, people have always said to me, oh, your energy is so calm, mm-hmm. or your voice is so peaceful, or you're so peaceful, which I think may be a reason why I first felt connected to you. I mm-hmm. think if you were to ask me the question of, was I restorative before I came into this work, or am I restorative as a result of this work? I think as a result of this work for me, I've learned to speak up and say, I've been harmed and this is what I need. And I think before this work, I was not able to do that.
Right. To articulate it that way.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I have a partner in life that has since I've known him, has been restorative in that sense. Mm-hmm. And that really taught me that. Mm-hmm. But I think it wasn't enough just to be in a partnership with someone who was able to do that, because it freaked me out. But I think this work, the practice of this work, and engaging other people in the practice of this work has helped me to name that
mm-hmm.
for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you bring the personal relationship, because I hope she wouldn't mind, but you know, my wife, she always throw that to my face, you know, when we fight, or we have an argument, you know, whatever. It's like, what are you supposed to, like,
no,
like you're a restorative, like you're doing uh-huh. that, you know, every day, like as a professional or whatever, mm-hmm. like you're supposed to be the restorative guy. Why are we even arguing? Like, why don't you listen to me, or why, you know, blah, 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 like all these things. And it really bothers me, because, you know, I think there's a good point, right? It's like, it's definitely easier to be a facilitator, kind of like removed from that conflict. But when you're yourself in those emotions, and, you know, and for whatever reason, or in that disagreement, how you can still keep that restorative frame, like mindset, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, you're not at your best, or, you know, you're not able to deal with your own emotion and still try to resolve. Being restorative doesn't mean that you have the answer for everything, mm-hmm. and that you can deal with any conflict in a great way and all smile, right? It's not like that. It's still those real pain, and whether you know your stuff, right, or you are restorative, or you think you're restorative, there's still those very hard moments where, like, just like pain and real things, you know.
I mean, my first year at Markham, when I was a coordinator, I would be so exhausted from all that I had to do in just one day. I would come home and I just wouldn't want to talk about. It was also a lot of traumatic things I was seeing and experiencing.
Yeah.
And I just would not have the energy to talk about it. And my partner George would come home, or he would come home or he would be there, or I would come home and he was working at a library at the time, and he was working in the evening. So sometimes by the time he would come home, I would already be going to bed, and he wanted to check in. And I would just say, you know, I don't want to talk about it right now. And he would get really upset.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we spent a few months in this pattern. And then I don't know if it was him, if it was me, it might have been him. I think there was a suggestion that on Friday night we would go out for dinner, and that at dinner, or like as we're eating dinner, I would tell him about my week.
Mm-hmm.
And that became the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think for me, I'm not the best listener, actually. I really have had to train myself to listen in all of the containers of the space that we hold, but in a one-on-one, not in a workspace, not in a restorative practice circle, whatever space, I can have a really hard time listening. So I've seen that at home in my relationship, and I think I've seen how years later, how I brought in this work in conversation. I think by saying specifically what I need is this, or I think with George saying, I can't have this conversation right now, or saying, mm-hmm. I can't actually listen to you right now,
mm-hmm.
but I can listen to you later or at this time or tomorrow. And I think it was hard for him to hear that. It was. But I think once he expressed to me that once he understood that that was what I needed,
mm-hmm.
he was able to take a step back. And so that was actually really powerful for me, for the both of us, again, because of this work.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I can definitely relate to that.
Which I feel like this connects to the constant need to be in relationship,
mm-hmm.
in order to really embody this work.
Right.
Because otherwise, it doesn't become real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great statement, yeah.
That's Big Joseph.
Yeah.
I want to say that as of this recording date, that this is Joseph's last day. So this is the last CCJ conversation time that we'll be having. Not the last conversation, but the last work time, CCJ time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to name, I think going back to, I think to have people witness the impact that you had on me, I remember, and I think going back to what we've been talking about right now, I think it was 2 years ago, it was May, and then we had a 3-day staff retreat. And I think this also connects to me still working on my listening. It was day 2 of a staff retreat. I had a headache that was becoming a migraine, and I wasn't taking the best care of myself in that moment. And we were doing some brainstorming work as a whole organization, and we were in the apartments, and we were trying to decide, I think, a part of actually what later became our implementation plan. And I just did not want to be in the space.
Mm-hmm.
I remember you had said something, and I like snapped like at the space and at you. And then later, Belly, our director, had to be like, you know, she had to check me. And so I think the next day I had to go to jury duty, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wasn't there for the last day. And so I remember thinking like, oh, I have to be accountable to what I did and name sort of where I was in that time. And I was really nervous. Because accountability is still something that I can struggle with, I think a lot of us on the team struggle with, in terms of relationship with each other. No matter how often we're in circle together, like we have been each month. Remember, I was really nervous to have a conversation with you. And I think later, maybe the week or so, I don't remember exactly, but I did pull you aside and I was like, hey, this is what was happening with me at the time. And you just want to, you know, say I'm sorry. And like, that was not, I didn't mean for it to come out that way and all that. And I remember the way in which you received that was really strong and powerful. And so for me, it became, that moment was a moment of like, yes, I can be, I need to hold myself accountable when I need to, and to be checked in the way that Belia did. But I think it was such a powerful moment because a year later, we had an intern that worked with us, and there was an agreement that wasn't kept. And then this intern, this person, went up to me in a similar way, and I had to receive his accountability. And it was a really beautiful, authentic receiving, and how I experienced him. And I think it reminded me, I think I remember thinking, feeling like your energy at that moment when I was experiencing with this other person. And so I just wanted to sort of name that and have people witness that and offer that as a gratitude to you in all these years that we've worked together in RJ in school. Even before it was RJ in school, it was just, you know, CCJ for Justice. And just express that to you, and with all of the intentions for the next journey, the next phase.
Thank you for that. I actually didn't like realize or remember exactly, but I thank you for sharing that. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a great journey for me, you know, TCJ and just embodying this work. And I also want to, you know, say that I feel very grateful to have been working with you and the other members of the team. But definitely just all the things that, you know, I learned from you. And I mean, to me, you're just you're a master of this work, you know? And so I really look up to you and, you know, we appreciated the work that we've been doing together and all of that. So thank you, really. And again, you know, we started with this talk with the importance of relationship. And definitely, I mean, I'll invite you to my, you know, next kid baptism and quinceañeras and whatever, you know.
I'm you're there. Definitely,
yeah, you'll be there. I know.
And
I
even know, if so. There is, even if it's not just for a baptismo,
no,
of for also
not.
You know, on a regular Saturday
or whatever. Yeah.
I'm there.
It took what, 3 years for us to get gorditas.
Gordita with Anna, with Joseph's partner. And I think on that note too, I think as the older I get, I also in time I'm having to like be super mindful to maintain friendships. Is also really, even we live in LA and we live in different cities, but that's not, just like time shouldn't be an excuse, like you were saying.
Yeah,
so I have to be, I do want to make a public commitment to go to the house, your house.
Yes, please.
In the fall.
It's also definitely something I'm struggling with, you know, keeping friendships.
You know, you're the only person that I could ask this question to on our team in, maybe it's probably its own podcast episode, but is there, Pierre calls you Papa Joe because Isabella will be like a year in August, I think, no?
In July.
So next, July,
month, yeah.
In a month from now. I'm curious, and again, we could just stop here, whatever, but as a parent, like, where do you practicing or learning or thinking about in terms of RJ being a parent?
Yeah. You're right. I think
question,
it could be another an hour podcast, and then you can invite, you know, you can invite me.
Okay, pues.
You
and Anna.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's still recent, right? Like, I mean, she's a year old, so she's our baby. But and maybe it's cliche. I mean, I'm sure people have heard that before. you know, it does change your focus, right? Like it's like you know how we say like RJ is a paradigm shift, or you know, well, being a parent is also a paradigm shift, definitely. But I'm definitely committed to bring that RJ into my parenting, and teaching. You know, I see myself being circle with her and you know, and like as a family and doing that kind of stuff for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a journey like that I'm starting mm-hmm. on as a dad, as a parent.
Mm-hmm. That is so, time and money and all of that we just talked about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, you know what, in 10 years, you know, we can do, I can tell you more about what I've practiced and what works and not as a parent.
Let's do it. I'm going to sign off. This has been What You Know About RJ, Restorative Justice, Sharing Stories and Skills, a podcast from the California Conference for Equality and Justice, Restorative Justice in Schools. Please visit our website, cacej.org, for our latest trainings and materials. And I'm going to pass the mic one more time to Joseph for any last thing you want to say, or lo que sea, whatever.
No, just thank you so much for having me, Gilbert. And, you know, doing great work with those podcasts. So keep it up.
Thank you. Nos vemos pronto.
Bye.
Bye, all. Thank you for listening.
Hey there, podcast listeners. I'm Jesse Needham, and here at CCEJ, my role is to make sure that we have the resources we need to do our work. This podcast was an offering of love from us to you. Are you curious to know more about restorative justice? If you enjoy listening and want CCEJ to produce more podcasts, we invite you to show gratitude by making a donation at our website, www.cacej.org/donate. And don't forget to like, subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. Your support will give us the resources we need to produce more restorative justice learning tools. Thank you.